You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on.
Good morning, gardeners near and far. This is the 3CR Gardening Show, and in Melbourne and surrounds, we're having very pretty weather. There was a beautiful sunrise as I walked over Fitzroy's Hill. It's definitely a day for gardening. However, I hope it's just as good for some of us, our far distant listeners. We have even listeners in Minnesota, in America, in England. So it's quite exciting to have listeners from everywhere. This morning, I've got three excellent people with me. John Arnott, horticulturalist, previous at Cranbourne previously, and has just returned from Buninyong Botanic Gardens, great botanic gardens person. Jay Iwasaki, who is a councillor at Merribeck and is a native bee and ecologist specialist, and Emmeline Bowman from STEM Landscape Architecture Design, who is an absolute specialist in setting up wonderful water gardens which take real notice of our natives, plants and animals. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I thought what we might do is just first talk a little bit about yourselves and what you've been doing.
Spring has sprung. Yes. We're a little bit different in our firm. We do a lot of hands-on work, so we're doing our plantings and all things like that, and still trying to design as well. We are in a little bit of a chaotic moment. We can't get enough plants at the moment.
Ah.
So just our selections of just standard things like scovola and brachyscome and orthoxanthus and all those sort of things are just not coming out.
Really?
Yeah, and it's happening all over, and we don't know if it might be that everyone might be getting really into natives and there's not enough production.
That would be wonderful.
Mm. I would hope that is it.
You were talking about the flowering things too, aren't you?
Yes.
Which will go first.
Yes. Or that it has been said, though, that we have had a particularly cold winter. And it's been
lagging.
And production is majorly lagging, and the backlog is huge, and all of our plantings at the moment are sitting right at the 20th of October, and there's a lot of them. So I'm a bit stressed. But our world is I think I'm focusing on that lately. It's, oh, God, how are we going to get all this done? I don't know how we're going to do it. It is literally the biggest backlog I've ever seen.
Oh, really? That's difficult.
Yeah, yeah. So that is a really hard thing to do when you are trying to run a business and do all those things. And obviously you don't want to plant too late either.
No.
Well, the Antarctic is 20 degrees hotter. It's still minus something or other.
Yeah.
But it's 20 degrees hotter than it should be in parts, and it's going to completely throw out the winds.
Right.
And we could be in for a very windy summer.
Oh, well, that dries it all out.
Which dries everything out, which makes it 10 times more difficult. And our garden, we haven't got it. My garden is still dry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm. It's funny, like, bringing up winds, because, you know, obviously, like, growing up on a farm, you know, it's those, when we'd irrigate all the paddocks and do all those sort of things, you know, you get, as soon as you irrigate and then you get the wind, you're just like, oh, that's gone. And it's amazing. It really is amazing how much moisture is taken out of the soil from wind.
Yeah. Indeed. Like, you normally think, okay, well, evaporation is solar radiation, sun, you know. The wind's the thing.
The wind is.
Even in the middle of winter.
Yeah.
Definitely.
You can have, rainfall can be outstripped by evaporation by just through the wind.
Yeah.
Well, that's what's happened to me the whole winter.
Yeah, right.
Every time we've had a bit of rain, we've just got these northwesterlies
that just strips it off.
It's a factor that's not spoken about much.
That's
and
not.
it is because of my growing up on the land that, you know, you do observe all those, you know, natural phenomena that, yeah.
Where was the land? Whereabouts?
East Gippsland.
Which part?
We're between Rosedale and Maffra. It's a little area called Winnandu. So near Avon Lakes and all those areas. But yeah.
It's moo cows, isn't it?
It's moo cows. Dad used to have sheep, but we have dairy and beef. Mm. Yeah, yeah. But okay. It is like a world that obviously gives you a very big perspective on obviously cultivated landscapes. Dad had a big creek that ran through the property, which he revegetated.
Nice.
So, you know, as a little child, seeing how I loved it in there, I would watch. I was there when it was like first planted and didn't understand what was really going on in the sense of like, you know, what that progression is, but I would watch and observe that the insects would come as the shrubs got bigger, then the birds would come, and as the trees became bigger, then the bigger birds would come, then the animals came in. You know, it was such a beautiful thing to witness, and in combination with the cultivation of the land and looking after those biodiversity spots and or high biodiversity areas, and then the cultivated land, how that starts to translate to each other. Such a great experience, and obviously water as well, how as it moves into the site. We had a lot of wetlands and, you know, the bulls dig holes. I don't know if people know this, but bulls are funny animals.
And dig holes?
They do. Sometimes I see them, it reminds me of human men. They dig holes.
Dug another hole. So,
no, they're like fighting and the girls go past, they get all excited. But the bulls dug hole. And a lot of the times when they dug them, it would hit a spring. You know, things would fill up. So the whole country was...
How wonderful Gippsland is.
It is. Oh, my God. Gippsland is so... It's incredible. Yeah. But, you know, all the way that water moves through the site, under the ground.
So no wonder you're so into water now.
I love water. I mean, I lived on that creek. I lived in there.
Which creek? What was the name of the creek?
It's Fells Creek.
Fells Creek.
Yeah. So, yeah, I lived there. And I used to take components of the creek and put it in my fish tank. And then I would see all my water bugs and, you know, how the plants would interact. And, you know, it was coming from, I got an aquarium, got like the standard goldfish, plastic plants, everything like that. Everything dies.
Yeah.
Pop everything from the creek, everything survives. So, yeah.
Early learning.
Yeah,
very early. And that is the fundamental learning. Basis of to like my knowledge of like systems today.
It's interesting, isn't it? The, you know, we tend to think of agriculture as being some sort of threatening process, and historically it has been, you know, the clearing of the land. But boy, oh boy, farmers that are in tune with the environment and sort of know how to work with it, you know, you know, they've got a vested interest in not flogging the property and making it unproductive.
They should be put on a pedestal.
They really should.
I think last time I actually said on the radio, it's been getting really disheartening because a lot of the farms are all being bought up, and they've just been bought by these huge, big private enterprises. And what's happening?
Multinational.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the problem is you are losing these beautiful people who do
know the land.
And they care for the land.
Oh, deeply.
Deeply. Yeah. And this is huge, and a lot of people in Melbourne don't realise this because they're still getting their food from Woolies and Coles, who, by the way, shouldn't even be putting their brand on the food that they're producing because they're just really a distributor of food. But, like, you know, it's just this really sad thing of we are not recognising the amazing people in everything, in horticulture, agriculture, whatever, you know, we're not recognising how amazing these people are, and we should be prioritising that over the greed that's happening.
My generation, I'm in my 70s, and my generation, there was barely a child at in my class at school who didn't have somebody in their family on the land. In my case, it was my grandfather.
Yeah.
You know, we were just, none of us thought that milk was produced in the supermarket. We all knew about moo cows.
Yeah.
And that is the other thing. I mean, we've always been a very urban society, but we've become so much more urban.
Yeah.
And it's becoming increasingly difficult, which is why this, you know, the Stephanie Alexander initiative to grow food in schools is just so incredibly important, and those sort of things. And, of course, I'll introduce Jay Iwasaki, who's new to the show, but not new to the station.
That's right. Hi, I'm Dr. Jay Iwasaki. I'm an ecologist and also a city councillor in Marybeck, representing half of Central Brunswick. And yeah, I'll just go on a bit, but I did a lot of research in native bee ecology in New Zealand for my PhD to get started. And we were looking at how native bees, which there's not very many in New Zealand, actually. There's only about 3 dozen compared to over 1,500 in Australia that have been described. So potentially up to 2,000 native bees in Australia.
2,000 species of native bees.
That's right.
So that's cool.
And that's not the wasps. That's just the bees.
That's just the bees. Thousands more wasps. But yeah, those bees are small and they don't really look like bees in the way that you think of a bee, which would be like a European honeybee or a bumblebee, both of which are, you know, brought over from Europe. We've got those beautiful blue-banded bees, which there are dozens of species of those.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And some social bees, but those don't come down to Victoria, unfortunately. But if you're
the social ones?
Yes. So if you're in, like, they go as far as south as Wollongong. So if you're down there, you can keep these Australian sugar bag bees that produce a kind of honey. But yeah, unfortunately, we don't get them down here. It's too cold.
Are there any native bees that I think you've just mentioned it,
yeah,
but are productive in terms of honey?
So just those sugar bag bees. That's they're right. Stingless bees, and they are very popular to keep. I think there's waiting lists to get hives of those.
Right.
May I ask, when they're not producing, obviously, a food source like sugar, how are they feeding their larvae and how does that all come? Is there any special species that you know of?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. Bees are, they're pretty much, they do the same thing. I like to call them vegetarian wasps. Mm. They just drink nectar and they eat pollen. And as an adult, they mostly just use the nectar as a, you know, carbohydrate food source. And they provision these little cells with a ball of pollen and nectar smushed up, and then they lay an egg on it, and that feeds the bee that develops, and that's the whole life cycle. They don't need to make honey unless they're doing like some kind of social hierarchy where they stay, you know, together in big hives, and that's not the usual thing that bees do.
Yeah.
Jay, I had the biggest gum tree in my garden. My garden must be about 5 or 6 acres, and the biggest gum tree in my garden fell down, and I had open garden scheme 10 days' time. So I immediately get, the local Wandon tree blokes in to, and he comes and he said, can't get the machinery in. I said, oh no, you know, I've got an open garden. He said, well, I can tidy it up. So he tidied it up, but we couldn't get rid of, so I had this huge root ball full of clay. And I don't know, it was partly Ben who comes on the show. Ben and I were looking at it and talking about it, and I decided to leave it. And I've now got this huge rose growing over it, which is in full flower at the moment, huge pink flowers. It's absolutely beautiful. And I've got a few other things growing over it to protect the clay. I've now got so many more blue-banded bees.
And
I've also got pardalots, which I've never had.
Yeah, okay. Perfect, yeah.
So it was the perfect example.
Yep.
Yeah.
You've created a
habitat.
A pardalot
and at
nesting
that,
site.
At that open garden, I'm sort of wandering around, you know, listening to, answering questions, listening to what people, and this woman says, oh, I think it's disgusting. She's just left this tree. I thought, I'm leaving it forever.
Okay. Well, that's what I'd love to, you know, bring to council in a way is it's not just about the things that you plant and replacing grass with flowering things. It's also getting that habitat for bees to nest in. And sometimes it's just bare ground.
Yeah.
Yes. So they've got the clay.
Just reflecting on this Wilson Botanic Park out in Berwick, hardly a stick of indigenous vegetation. Mm. You know, there's some tussocks of kangaroo grass and a few. There's a few, but it's predominantly a non-native landscape, full of biodiversity, full of birds, bees.
When I moved to my
butterflies.
Place, John, I had no small birds at all. Mm. I've now got weebills, thornbills. I've got pardalots, I've got everything, and it's because of the salvias.
Salvias are amazing.
Yeah, so I guess it's the question, it's about habitat composition and structure and arrangement and species.
And size.
Yeah.
You know, they need and size and they want something a bit thorny or thick so they can hide in.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you are sort of appealing to the generalist species, though, not the specialist.
Of course, absolutely.
So it is about having that diversity and exotics and everything.
Not necessarily endorsing that, but
I'll tell people like why it is that you do have diversity of exotic and native species, because they are specialist species that require certain others.
So important. And we want to bring back wildlife into our cities, and
absolutely
the ones that are here already are the generalists, and they do very well, and we want to make sure that we can support the specialists as well, which is a little bit more work. And they may also need to bring them in, actually. Like, bees can be translocated once you bring that habitat in, and then they can, you know, it's a lot of work to cross over from those intact areas. So
it's interesting, isn't it? There's a kind of a preservation versus conservation. Yeah, sometimes I wonder, I don't think we can ever... I don't know. This is an interesting question. I question the ability to be able to do ecological restoration with the same suite of species, is functioning in the same way as a pristine habitat. No.
Yeah.
It's just impossible.
It's impossible. It's a cultivated landscape. It'll never be exactly the same.
Yeah.
And the other thing that everyone has to recognise too is that when you're dealing with different environmental types, it is very specific to a certain bunch of species.
Yeah.
So when you start altering it, you're almost either... not allowing certain other species and then allowing a whole range of new species. Mm. So it doesn't mean that, like, when something is untouched, that the biodiversity is, you know, that high. Yeah. It's just specific to what those species like in that environment. In our urban environments, we actually see quite a huge amount of biodiversity just purely because of the diversity of plants that we use.
In people's gardens.
Yeah, but we cannot... That's the thing. A lot of people go, oh, is it purist? But it's like, no. It's about... It will never be the same. No. All the places that we have touched, it doesn't. It's not meant to be the same. It can't be.
Yeah, it was actually interesting. About 10 years ago, it was all the rage in ecology, these called novel ecosystems.
Novel ecosystems, yeah.
And, so it's a kind of philosophical approach too, isn't it? Just like, what do we want to see? What can we see? What do we expect? And where do we go from there?
Mm.
But if they're not pristine, aren't they novel by default? It's a really interesting space, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah, even if you do have pristine, you know, ecosystems within an urban area, if it's not connected to the wider ecology that's similar, it would be very difficult to maintain sustainable populations of whatever would have been there, just because of the connectivity and the size. Species go extinct all the time and then recolonize from, you know, locally extinct and have to be recolonized from bigger patches, and that's just ecology. But it's hard if it's isolated.
I think the Cranbourne Gardens is a really interesting example of that. You know, it's nearly 1,000 acres, so 360 hectares of indigenous vegetation. But it's increasingly being surrounded by urban conditions, suburban condition, with
really
a suburb.
The change is extraordinary,
so this
isn't
little,
it?
This little island of...
Quite a big island.
Well, probably the biggest patch of that sort of heathy woodland anywhere, which is left intact. But in 10 years' time, it'll be completely surrounded by urban condition.
Yeah.
And there's attempts to sort of punch... corridors and biolinks and those types of things, but it's challenging.
That's it. That's the number one reason. The biggest reason I ran for council is that we need to have green corridors crisscrossing everywhere, so that there is that connectivity, so things can establish and re-establish over and over again, and have that diversity.
All strength to your bow.
So,
all strength to your bow.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
but it is very difficult. It's interesting. In my patch, in the Upper Yarra Valley, the department has taken an initiative which is really interesting because, you know, it's the Yarra and you've got big creeks running into it and some smaller ones. And most of those creeks, the edge of it is Crown land.
Okay. Mm.
And they're taking back the Crown land from the farmers who are furious.
For biodiversity.
Right. To stop the cattle ruining the connections.
If they do that, though, then they need to be able to put in a proper management system to be able to help them, because
they've got to help with the water for the
they
farmers.
They have to. Mm. And that's and then obviously you've got different landowners, and some of them look after their creeks, some don't. And usually for an initiative like that is probably due to some landowners not looking after the creek. But if they were to take all of them, then they need to take on that responsibility of maintenance, and they need to know the vegetation.
Yeah.
They need to put in the time. And this is the thing, when you hear these sort of silly moves, I find them silly, because it's like, yes, you want to restore and there should be initiative to look after it, but there should be more of like engaging the landowner, giving them some sort of
I think help they're very assistance. Concerned
some support
because yeah. I know I've seen this before, it gets left
and then at the moment they are definitely engaging the landowners, yeah. and they are getting they're getting big support group, friends yeah. groups.
That's good.
That's
because
good.
They're stretching from Cockatoo to Healesville.
Yeah.
yeah.
And the chance of making those corridors
yeah.
is fantastic.
Yeah.
Because you know what happens in those high rainfall, riparian, you know, things like Pithospora mandulatum, if they're not managed, they just become the dominant thing.
Yeah.
I find this whole Pithospora thing so interesting, because if you look at along the Little Yarra, which stretches through just below me, past me, if you look at the earliest stuff from the people that lived there, moved in there, the first white settlers, they talk about Pithospora undulatum. So it was obviously living there beforehand.
Yeah, it just got ecologically way out of whack. It kind of belongs in a fair bit of country in Victoria, but it's moved into some areas where it never was and becoming a bit dominant.
Mm, yeah.
Well, it's reproducing on my place all the time. I'm always pulling it out. But the thing that I like about it is that it doesn't burn. No. You know, it's people are planting oak trees because they don't burn. Well, I think, a Pithospora is a bit more natural than an oak tree because it is
beautiful
indigenous.
Fragrance.
It smells very good. I do wonder that, because when you do have a plant that's obviously being distributed by animal species as well, and the environment's changing, is this like an adaptation that's happening? And you know what, you know, it starts to beg that, you know, conversation around there. And I guess too,
is it okay?
And Virginia is right. It does have qualities that, not like a eucalypt, it doesn't combust.
Well, yeah, what you're talking, you're talking about an ecological balance.
Exactly.
And when things get imbalanced, things grow out of whatever their balance would have been and become dominant when they may not have been historically. But
yeah.
the other aspects that kept them in check are now gone and they can just explode.
Yeah, there is part of the world that it's we're seeing the change. And yes, some of it's, I mean, all of it is induced by us. But at the same time, Mother Nature knows how to restore itself. And sometimes, yeah,
Well, people are totally obsessed with removing it around me. And I think there's other things they could obsess on a bit more, like blackberries.
Yeah.
I've just been up in central western New South Wales.
I was just going to ask you about this, John. Tell people where you've been.
I've been up at Burrendong Arboretum, which is between Orange and Dubbo. And that site, it hasn't been actively managed for, I don't know, maybe let's call it 15 years. So all of those colonising, nature hates a void.
Yes.
So, you know, there's an amazing collection of wattles, like an amazing collection of wattles. And I don't know, 10 of those they've moved into the balance of the site. So they're doing what wattles do. They're primary colonisers and they're colonising the site. But it was interesting. I was dropped off at Cootamundra station and I thought, well, this is the epicentre
<Here it is. laughs>
of this weedy wattle, which has, you know, migrated from the central west of New South Wales, and, you know, it's practically everywhere. Burrendong Arboretum, it's a very, very special place.
I grow a Burrendong hakea.
Well, it turned up at the Burrendong Arboretum. It's a naturally occurring hybrid. Well, it's a hybrid between two of the cultivated species, both Western Australian, that was kind of spotted there. And it's, I don't know, it's arguably one of the most commonly cultivated hakeas around.
It's pretty.
It's beautiful. It's a gorgeous plant.
I also grow that other one that's really spiky with the pink flowers, and I hate it, but the birds love it.
Dacurrens?
Ceresia? Dacurrens?
Dacurrens, I think. Dacurrens. I really don't like it, but, you know, the birds adore it, so I've got no choice. It has to stay there.
So I'd spent the week up there. I'm helping the Burrendong Botanic Garden and Arboretum with their living collections plan. So, it's a really interesting site. It was established in the 1960s by a guy called George Olfefer, who was, you know, in amongst the Neil Marriotts and the Roger and Gwen Elliotts and, you know, one of those pioneers, Floyds. And he started up a business called Nindathana Seeds, which is now, you know, an extraordinary seed.
He's Nindathana?
He's the founder of Nindathana Seeds. And so he had collected, he did a lot of collecting himself all through, you know, New South Wales and Queensland. So he was a proper plant collector. But with the seed company, he had collectors all over Australia collecting for the seed company. And it would sort of arrive in the mail probably at Burrendong. And he'd say, some for Nindathana seeds, some for the Arboretum. So the access to wild collected material from all over Australia, you know, it was just phenomenal. The living collection there. I would have loved to have been able to time travel back to 1980 just to see this place in its yeah. full glory. 4,500 different plant species have been through that collection. Hmm. Something like 560, 570 species of eucalypts,
wow.
Carimbias, angophoras, and eucalypts. Now, they're not all there because, you know, it really hasn't been managed for the last 15 years. So a big part of what we need to do there is kind of go through and audit what has survived, you know, to work out. So what's going on there. But, you know, an incredible site with this really wonderful backstory. Yeah, so I've had a terrific time contemplating things like colonising weeds and what their role is. Mm. Yeah, it's been interesting.
John would have been so happy. You would have been so happy.
I was very
like a pig in mud.
Yeah, I was.
Unfortunately, or a guy in the bush.
Unfortunately, I had responsibilities to sort of document this and write it, so I did spend a chunk of time in a really horrible motel room in Wellington just writing stuff. Oh. But it was a great week.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a really great week.
What a story.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
But an amazing place, yeah.
So incredible.
Nindathana seeds, Ulfa. Prostantheras.
Yeah.
There's 107 species of Prostantheras in the Australian flora. Nearly half of those can be found within 150 kilometres of Burrendong.
Really?
Yeah, and there's a book called, and I need to be careful how I say this, The Cradle of Incense. Not the Cradle of Incest. the Cradle of Incense, which talks about this, you know, this phenomenon of Prostanthera diversity in and around central New South Wales.
Mm.
So, you know, an incredible, and there's a Prostanthera collection.
That's an amazing thing to know.
Yeah, and you know, one of the, I guess the, you know, one of the really important collections is this collection of Prostanthera. So we're working out how to sort of get it back. So it honours the past, it honours the contribution of, you know, the founding fathers, but it's sustainable within the context of Burrendong now. So it's a really interesting gig. Really interesting gig. Yeah.
This is the 3CR Gardening Show. I'm Virginia Hayward, and with me are John Arnott, Jay Iwasaki and Emmeline Bowman. We've got two free tickets, two free double passes, one to each of the two gardens that are open next weekend for Open Gardens Victoria. And if people ring into the station on 94190155, they can have a bash at grabbing one of these free tickets. The gardens, one is the Wattle Tree Garden in Hurstbridge, a bushland garden meandering through gums and metal sculptures. The owner of this garden is a sculptress. And the other one is Inga's Little Garden in Diamond Creek. Started as a veggie garden journey throughout COVID, like so many people, and has literally taken her veggie garden has taken over the whole back garden with 20 raised beds and glass houses. And so there's two quite different gardens close to each other, and they sound really interesting.
They went down the rabbit hole.
Yes. So if you want to speak to our producers on 94190155, or you can text us on 0488 809 855. And if you want to send in a question because you're too far away to ring us, or you haven't got proper reception, or you're listening to us on the podcast, gardening@3cr.org.au. And we also have a question on screen, which I think probably is for you, Jay, or maybe you, Emily. It's from Di in Northcote. How do I find out about insects and animals in my suburb?
Ooh, good question. It's just, I guess it depends on which ones, but I guess you just email me and I'll give you some specifics. There are some great groups in along the Mary Creek, like Mary Creek Management Committee and Friends of Mary Creek, that would have that information for Darebin and Eastern Marybeck. Maybe those are the community groups to start with. But for birds, I like to use eBird, which is an amazing resource by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And that's got all your bird watching needs there. Atlas of Living Australia. John, you might have some suggestions.
No, ALA is a good one.
There's this book that I have and I love it. And it's called Melbourne's Wildlife. And it's a great book which actually it separates all those little groups.
Melbourne's Wildlife.
Oh, cool.
It's really, really good. And it's
That's a physical book?
It's a field guide to Melbourne flora.
Awesome. That's great.
And
yeah.
It's a wonderful book. I was just trying to find the person who wrote it because I doesn't have it on the front cover. I was like,
while you look for that, what is eBird? Explain that to us properly.
eBird is a project by the Cornell University Lab of Ornithology to engage residents, citizen scientists, in documenting what birds are in their area so that they can identify long-term trends of decline or changes, and you can contribute just by downloading the app or doing it online. I guess I'm now in that stage where I'm just like, there's all these apps and here's what you use. But yeah, there's some great books out there too. And I got started on field guides myself.
And so the eBird app you just find by typing in eBird.
Correct, yes.
With one E.
One E.
I would also say, especially around Melbourne region, there's a lot of nurseries, like series nurseries, and they actually have all the guides there. You can literally find a guide for insects, birds, mammals, you know, reptiles. They will have like flip fungi books.
And Ceres, of course, is for Di in Northcote.
Exactly.
Oh, it's perfect.
So it's a perfect spot. And then you'll be able to, yeah, have all those species that you're seeing across the Mary. The book is just it's published by CSIRO. It's called Melbourne's Wildlife, a Field Guide to the Fauna of Greater Melbourne.
Awesome.
This book is fantastic.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I need to get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty expensive now. I don't know. Maybe the copies aren't.
Is that a print or something?
Yeah, when you just have books on your shelf and all my staff, like if they're looking, I'm like, here. There you go. Have a look. You know, sometimes because it's like everyone does come with a wealth of knowledge and you can, you know, list everything. But sometimes,
Have you guys used iNaturalist as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so good.
But I had an interesting one near me and I'm very interested to your response to this because iNaturalist has called for people to be citizen scientists tell.
Yeah.
And we have got a big creek running through Seville. And some friends of mine were walking on part of the creek. The creek runs a long way past Seville and eventually gets to the river, the Yarra River, and they saw a platypus.
Oh, cool.
Very cool.
Yeah.
But then they didn't report it to iNaturalist because they thought the poor thing is just going to be
looked at and people
walking their dogs are going to come looking for it and not necessarily have their dogs on the lead, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought it was a very interesting response from my friends.
It's a bit like the powerful owls that they saw up in Eltham. And it's kind of good. Like a lot of people would say, we're not going to give the location just to make sure people don't get
there. Yeah, that's fair enough.
You know, there is those.
But when the powerful owl was in the Botanic Gardens, everybody knew it and it didn't seem to care about us.
Yeah,
no, that's right.
There's a bit of both, you know, I guess.
You could tell where it was from the dead possum stuff underneath.
Why is there carcasses and skeletons? You see this giant beast of a bird.
That's amazing. Some things are great, like eBird kind of sensors where the sensitive species are, for example. Okay. Mm. So some are taking that into account.
But see, that's exactly. That's what we need, maybe.
Yeah. Mm.
The thing is, people who are looking and they see that there's been a spotting of an animal, the general people aren't going to go check. It's the enthusiasts that love them and respect them. And so I'm a little bit, I think you can say that they are there, but I truly believe the good people are the ones who are actually wanting to look at
and
these
do it
species.
Ethically and properly.
Absolutely.
The thing that worries me is the leaderless dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
I could get this wrong, but I think 5 years ago there was a sighting of a scarlet honeyeater, I believe, at the Cranbourne Gardens.
How exciting.
And at 9 o'clock, there was cars, birdos. There was this string of maybe 15 cars all coming because of the Coconut Telegraph kicked in, and people knew that there was that they were there, and there was people just it was an epicenter for the birdos that weekend. It's kind of nice.
I've taken my flatmate to the airport at like 5 a.m, skipping an exam so he could go chase a bird from Siberia once. I got paid $20.
Oh, and I love that. I think like the passion of these people, it's and fantastic. I think they're bringing that energy and that love for these species. And
well, I have proof of you loving this because I hopped on the 86 tram a while ago, and I was sitting next to this woman. We started talking, and she was really into Merri Creek, and she delivered some documents to my place, and I'm reading and thinking, oh, this is fantastic, gardening for wildlife leaflet about the area. And then I get to the end and it says STEM, and I think, oh my god, Emily is doing this too.
I do, my staff laugh at me because I do all these things for like free. So when I'm procrastinating, I do brochures on wildlife and habitat gardens and Ricalis. Oh my goodness.
The best kind of procrastination I've ever heard.
I've got the Ricali one. She gave me that. This is Caroline. And I was so pleased to meet this woman on the tram.
Yeah, she's wonderful. She is wonderful. She's a really, really passionate woman.
But what Di, who texted in, you, Caroline, you've met, I met this woman on the tram, we're all talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
Which, and this is what is important, there is people wanting to do this.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have all these wonderful parks in Victoria that don't have any understory at all. They've got grass and trees.
Mm. And I'd love to just go on about that because I've tried really hard in Marybeck in the last, since I've been on council, to change how we see parks. So there's some researchers at RMIT who study noisy miners. Everyone may be familiar with noisy miners and how how noisy they are, how much they bully other birds out. And they love a lawn with a tree in it, especially eucalypt, because they're honey eaters that have evolved that kind of affinity, and they can handle our disturbance really well. They really like our parks. And so when we take out the understory and create these environments for them, it's really just like heaven for them and not great for other species. But that's how we do parks, is exactly what they want. And so we need to change how we see a park. And it's, you know, we aesthetically like a tree with a lawn and it's good to sit in, but it's terrible for anything but noisy miners. Mm. Yep. And I've been swooped by them. I've been hit in the face with one on my bike.
Oh, yeah, they're quite aggressive.
Yeah, that's right.
But, I mean, I'm sorry they hit you in the face, but I'm much more concerned about the small birds.
Oh, yeah, but fair enough, me too.
And my own garden is just absolute proof. You put in the understory, the small birds will move in.
And they do.
We could do it in all our...
Yeah.
But and you know what it's about. It's about labour. It takes more labour, so therefore it's more expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to get political, but what are the
you
barriers?
You can get political on this station.
Yeah. but what are the barriers for having that sort of more biodiverse, more scrubby, three layers?
It's more complex to manage. Yeah. It may be more expensive to put in initially. And, you know, I mean, I think you can put in understory and just kind of let it go and you don't have to manage it, but then it becomes maybe quote unsightly for people and they come by and they're like, why isn't council managing this better?
Yeah.
I want my clean, tidy lawn. Even if you're not mowing grass, like we're trying a biodiversity trials in Marybeck where we're not mowing in certain areas, still getting complaints about it. And then...
Are you?
Yep. Everybody, but just sometimes it's, oh, this is council trying to save money. It does save money, but also brings wildlife in, and there's documented evidence of that in trials. So
it's become terribly fashionable in Britain to actually leave the meadows.
Rewild.
To rewild. There's a film on at the moment, actually, about the famous NEP, K-N-E-P-P, in our cinemas at the moment about rewilding in Britain.
I still think, though, when, like, nature strips have left, the sad reality is there's a lot of kikuyu grass and it might be better when this is happening. It's like doing a bit of a test where it's like, oh, let's remove all that kikuyu and plant a whole lot of native plants like Diclonacne and Ostrostipa and all those species and poas, and then interplant, you know, flowering species. And once that kikuyu has gone, because that will just take over everything, then let that go.
Mm.
Because then you get, you know, something a bit better, and then people who are more like ecologically minded and they know what sort of plants are there aren't going to go, oh my God, it's just a big mass of kaikuyu.
Yeah.
That's the hard part when you're trying to create
that. I think all of the above. I think just like let it rip, let it go, put some signs up. This is what this is, because if it's not grass and it has a flower on it, it's probably food for something.
Of course.
And so, I mean, that's the preferred approach. That'd be beautiful.
Yeah. But there's always money.
Yeah.
Well, it's not only money. That also means that you need some horticulturists that have the knowledge in that council. And employing horticulturalists has not been very high on a council
profile. I think is that where we need to have the conversations of the shift, you know? It's like putting a bit more priority on people with that knowledge and having part of the funding in there rather than, I don't know, I mean, poor Jay, like you're like, of course, I've been dealing with this the whole time, man. You have no idea about the funding and the process. And
I think we just need to put more signs up so people can learn about what's happening. Them. And then they're not as, oh, it's I get it. It's something cool. And I everyone wants more green things and more wildlife in their area. I think it's rare to meet someone who doesn't.
Yeah, of
course. Does it necessarily have to be something which looks wild and, you know, unmanaged in order to get biodiversity net gains? Can you still have a managed landscape, pruned, ornamental, and fulfil that habitat role?
Yeah, I mean, yes. And obviously, like we talked about before about hierarchies, it just means that there will be a selective amount of species that will be encouraged to that garden. So you can absolutely still have dense shrubbery that allows for, like, all your silver eyes and you know, little wee bills and things like that. And then you could have a lawn which, you know, appeals. I mean, if you clip it and everything, though. But, yeah, sometimes that'll still appeal to, like, your corellas and things like that.
I'd love to tell, like, there's a really cool bit of research came out of the US recently about hummingbirds. And if you've ever been to Los Angeles, you may have seen a lot of hummingbirds on New Zealand flax, which is planted widespread throughout the city, and also heliconia, so also not native. But In this new novel habitat, the hummingbirds have evolved to have longer bills because there's more food for them. And so there's more competition. So now they've got to compete among themselves in a way that they never have, and it's feeding their evolution.
We're going to have
things like that happen
that
here
is
as
extraordinary.
Well.
This makes me, because like when I was doing my master's, I did it about the cohabitation of animal and human species in Melbourne. And it's about the adaptability of these species within Melbourne. And then when they adapt to these urban environments, they are evolving. They are evolving to coexist with people. Like what you said with the hummingbirds, they are adapting their beak sizes to be appropriate for the certain plants that are in Melbourne as well, or any city. It is wild. And this is like where I get so excited, because when I was doing all this research, you know, it was like looking at blue-banded bees and different types of bee species that were, you know, making holes in the mortar types of old buildings because of the sand they used to use within old mortar. It was like these species are adapting, and the whole ethos of my project was just being like, we've got these incredibly adaptive species that are smart, that have learnt to coexist with us. There are other species that want to do that too, but might be a little bit more specialist and might need a little bit more of help, like by bringing in native plants.
A particular species that hosts them. That
sort of thing. Yeah. And what we are seeing, because I did that, this was my research, like, 14 years ago. And it's so exciting because literally from doing that project, I was the first student who'd ever even looked at animals in research in landscape architecture.
Wow.
And now look at what's happening with councils and the city. We are bringing it back and it's coming to life. These species are coming in. The biodiversity is increasing. It's so exciting.
Yeah. I guess I wonder, you know, in your perspective, like what might be, why do we need wildlife in cities? From your perspective, for me, my thing is all about education and getting people connected to these things so that we don't lose them everywhere that they are. But yeah, like it's an interesting question, right?
Yeah. I mean, myself too is to be connected. Absolutely. I think we're, as a human species, tend to fall away from our natural environment, and humans and animals have always coexisted and we should coexist. There is, if you want to even go down to scientific analysis of things, we are healthier. when we're surrounded by animals.
I was going to say,
songbirds actually open you up and reduce your stress. Songbirds also help with plant life as well. The actual song, they've actually done research that plants are growing better and they'll actually respond to the certain birds that are in the area because they know that that's what I need to have host on me.
Really?
Yeah, that's amazing. It's incredible. We have so many unconscious connections to animals and wildlife, that biophilia concept that this is the greater thing and we are meant to be custodians and guardians, and we're also meant to be surrounded and with our non-human kin.
And I think the mental health benefits are well documented.
Documented. And you can see, like, people who just live on the land, how different we are, you know. I even notice when I go home to Gippsland, just, like, looking at skin of people at Gippsland, their skin looks cleaner, you know, because they're surrounded by plants.
It's a better environment.
It's a better, and obviously it's cleaner and we're not got all those chemicals that we got here in the city.
Yeah.
But, like, look.
The term you used then was biophilia.
Yes.
What's that?
It's a biophilia is the
love of life.
Love of life and plants and being surrounded by green. And I think it was derived by Edward O. Wilson, is it?
Yes, name? I used to work in that department, actually. I've held the door for Ed.
Did you? Oh, my God, I'd be a moment. I would probably be, like, shaking.
I was like, oh, my God.
You worked for the Department of Biophilia.
Well, you wrote a book a long time ago.
Yeah, Biophilia Concept.
Oh, I'm going to chase that up.
It's to be surrounded by plants and wildlife and the association that we have being surrounded by this. It should be just, like, plastered everywhere.
Who was the author?
Edward O. Wilson.
Edward O.
American. He died a few years ago, but was originally an ant biologist.
He's just fantastic. There's just so many beautiful people. And can I just say, it was very sad this week to hear the passing of Jane Goodall.
Yep.
We were very fortunate. It was probably about 5 years ago, we were doing programs with the Roots and Shoots program with Jane Goodall's Institute here in Australia. We taught kids how to, you know, create, like, bug hotels and bee hotels and, you know, not that it was more for that, it was more for, like, wasp species and, you know, mud wasps and things, spiders. But, you know, just this great thing of educating. Like, this woman is just so wonderful on so many levels, and what she's spread throughout the world. And education, as Jay said, is the key. You know, it's educating these children who are going to be adults one day, who are going to be the new leaders and new people within organisations. They're going to push, you know, not push, but, you know, try and bring in new ways of thinking about our environments, I think. So.
And she was so beautifully measured.
So just everything, like even having to be recognised, so she got her PhD so she could be recognised under the scientific community.
And she was also so charming.
So charming.
Yes. She'd regularly come to my university in New Zealand that I did my PhD at, in the zoology department, and meet all the students.
Oh, and my goodness.
It's really nice.
So you actually had her come to your... Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, there was a close relationship with one of the researchers there. And she you know, travels a lot.
Yeah.
Gets to inspire students all over the world.
She's just
so you've met her on a couple of occasions.
Just the one day at the University of Otago.
Were you pinching yourself?
Oh yeah, I mean, it was a great day with students. Yeah, yeah, I mean, all PhD students. It's the zoology department's great there, and universities are great. People get to travel and meet their heroes. So I met E.O. Wilson giving talks in universities. So
I would. I don't really look up to many people, but I would drop and probably crawl around. Oh, I'm so excited. I don't.
Is the only autograph I've ever asked for?
I've only ever done that one before, and that was Uncle Jack Charles.
Oh, amazing.
I love him.
Yeah.
But I don't usually look up, but I think I would just crumble. I remember because David Attenborough came. He came to in person to Australia. I was just in the stand, like, crying my eyes out. I can't believe it. It's these people, just beautiful people. But, yeah, Jane, I've put my hat off to you, Jane. Thank you very much for everything you've done.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This is the 3CR Gardening Show. I'm Virginia Haywood, and with me are John Arnott, Jane Iwasaki and Emmeline Bowman. I thought it was probably a good idea to actually mention what is on for the next couple of weeks, couple of months. Mm. There's a huge amount on at the moment. The Tulip Festival is still running in Sylvan, And so you can go there today if you wish. And the Orchid Spring Show is on at several public halls. So if you're into orchids and you live in that direction, that is something to do today. On Sunday the 19th, for those people who are obsessed with clivias, the just about the best collection of clivias in Victoria is opening for one day for selling some plants. So this clivia sale is at 81 Invermay Road in Monbulk, and he does have the most fabulous collection.
Wow. Is that a registered collection? This
He is going to register it with Plant Trust. Yeah, great. And the Plant Trust Christmas party is going to go and visit his collection.
Terrific.
Which will be fun.
Great.
And the other thing that's on today and yesterday is Bolobec Spring Plant Fair. And if you are one of those people who are really wondering how to get hold of Meg's new book on salvias, which is fabulous.
It is a manual.
Look at it.
Yeah.
It is thick. It's almost heavy.
It's hefty. Yeah. Hefty salvia book.
And it is so beautiful. Yeah. All the paintings in there she did herself.
Oh, Meg is beautiful. Oh,
isn't she special?
Oh, yeah.
And if you want to buy that book, you can buy it at the salvia stand at Bolobec today.
It's on the shelves at the Royal Botanic Gardens.
Not yet.
It will be. Okay.
And we will keep people informed as it moves around. It is for sale at Craig's nursery, but his nursery is closed just at the moment.
Okay.
Because he has had to go to hospital. On the 11th, we'll do October quickly. On the 11th, Gippsland Rare and Unusual Plant Fair at Jindavik, a fabulous fair. On the 18th and 19th, Sip and Bloom, which is at St Anne's Winery in Murnong, and they've got some fabulous speakers. Chloe Foster, Sandra Schwartz, Craig Castry, all of whom have been on our show.
Presenter lineup.
Yeah. And Philip Vaughan is going to be there and more. Okay. So that will be excellent. St Anne's Winery in Murnong, 18th and 19th. The Clivia Sale on the 18th. Royal Botanic Gardens Melbourne Plant Sale, which is always fabulous. That's on the 18th and 19th. And Rushall Community Garden in North Fitzroy is having its open day from 12 till 2, and that's in Rushall in North Fitzroy.
And another plant sale in October is the Cranbourne plant sale.
Next week.
Saturday the 11th to Sunday the 12th, so next weekend, the Growing Friends at the Cranbourne Gardens have got their plant sale. It's both Saturday and Sunday. From 10 till 4 on both days. And, you know, just access to some really lovely material, which is kind of the Australian garden.
Those two plant sales, Melbourne and Cranbourne, are absolutely brilliant.
They're
shout out to Marianne.
Yeah, shout out to Marianne and Co.
Thanks, Mary. And Co. Oh, it's Marianne's just so wonderful. She always checks, like, Em, do you need anything?
Get the trolley ready.
Back up the ute.
On the 23rd, which I think is a Thursday... Oh, excuse me. At Royal Botanic Gardens Melbourne, there is a book launch, a photography forage into fungi, and Dr. Tom May will be talking. So that will be extremely interesting. The 25th is Burnley College's open day. On the 25th and the 26th, Gardenervalia Festival of Gardens in Gippsland, they have got 16 open gardens.
Wow.
I know. Oh, I so want to go. Alexandra and District are open the same day and they have got 8 gardens, and they are always brilliant, the ones up around Alexandra. And the Fernie Creek Flower Festival is on that weekend. So the 25th and 26th, God only knows what you're going to do with yourselves.
Spring.
Now, I'm going to fly through November because these will all get listed again. The first weekend of November is the Upper Yarra Valley Open Gardens. There's 5 gardens from Yellingbow to Gladysdale. The 8th and 9th is the Yarra Valley Plant Fair, and we will do an outside broadcast from there. That weekend also is the City of Monash Open Gardens, which is free entry to 5 gardens. And then on the 15th... is an important one for us, which is the Kiss the Ground is going to be shown at the Horticulture...
Fernie Creek
Horticultural Society. Virginia goes completely blank. Nothing wrong with her. the thing with this is that this is a really special film about this same topic as that we're working on today, which is so important. And basically, what if there is a viable solution to climate change? Treasured Perennials are sponsoring a screening of Kiss the Ground documentary, exploring how, through our soils, we can stabilise the Earth's climates, restore lost ecosystems and provide food security. So that's at Ferny Creek Horticultural Society on November the 15th from 11:30 to 4. And it will be excellent. Ferny Creek is up in the Dandenongs at Sassafras. I think I've stopped. Except, of course, for the 3CR garden party on the 23rd.
Yeah.
And the Plant Trust Christmas party on December the 7th.
So Meg's book is circulating around the studio, and I'm just looking at it. There are over 60 pages of cultivation notes, 10 different species to a page. So this, in the order of 600 detailed cultivation notes for each of the salvias and, you know, cultivars and varieties. I'll pick one at random. Salvia amplexicaulis, herbaceous perennial, winter dormant, height 20, width 30, flowers are lavender blue or light purple from summer. Hardy to heat, dry, cold and frost, full sun to part shade in moist, well-drained soils propagate by blah, blah, blah. I mean, that's extraordinary for single entry. Yeah,
and then at the back, the most fantastic photographs.
Yeah, then you can see the photos.
So that you can actually identify.
Actually see the things.
Yeah. Because that's one of the problems. It's difficult to identify a plant sometimes.
It can be, yeah.
And she has the most wonderful photos.
Yeah.
And some beautiful drawings. No, it's a fabulous book. I'm so excited with it.
Yes.
And we will keep talking about where you can get it.
Yeah.
And the Salvia Study Group is one of those places at the moment.
Mm. Yeah.
And anyone in the Yarra Valley who wants to contact me, I can,
you can
get your copy.
You've got copies. I mean, we interviewed Meg really briefly on the show a couple of weeks ago, but she is a treasure. A national treasure, you know, the support that she's given to the Royal Botanic Gardens, just as an example, it's been incredible.
She is the only person, the only volunteer who's allowed to work with the Horti staff.
Only
person.
Well, she's
all the rest of us volunteers, we're allowed to do all sorts of things, but we don't get to work with the Hort staff.
And
she's dead special.
Yeah. And she walks around with a uniform on.
Mm. Does she?
Yeah.
Oh, Meg, yeah.
Go, Meg.
Go, girl.
Yeah. No, it's incredible.
And I think people should try and come to Kiss the Ground because it is an amazing film and it's this sort of topic that we're talking about today. Mm. And there'll be stalls there and plant sales. And
yeah, it's like a little mini festival.
Hey, it'll be brilliant. Mm. Brilliant.
That's cool.
Great. Mm. So much on.
Spring.
Feels so busy already. Yeah. And then
I feel like I need a nap already.
Oh, sometimes I do find this time of year, like I want to go to everything and then it comes to the weekend and I'm like,
I can't go to anything.
I'm just sitting, have my little cup of tea or coffee. Oh, I need a few hours of silence. I don't need anyone around me. Leave me alone.
Just regenerate yourself.
Yeah, you just get really, just look at the birds.
Let me just give you those numbers again.
Some biophilia.
Yeah, it heals me very much, sorry.
9419-0155 to talk to us, or 0488-809-855 if you'd like to send us a text message. I think we should talk about a few plants, because that's what we do.
Sure.
Sure, who's going to... Oh, we've got all got one. Okay. Should we go... Oh, you go... No,
you go first.
I'll be quick.
Please.
I got two. You don't have to be quick.
I don't...
It's half past eight.
I just get excited hearing about other people's plants. Okay, so I've gone pink today. I've got two species.
Oh, lovely.
Very pink.
Oh, lovely.
Beautiful. Oh, yeah. From other sides of Australia. So... Who wants to start with the native or the local? Which one? What do you want?
The local.
We'll go local.
Because the local is the one that's relevant to
what we're talking
serious
about.
Serious biodiversity.
Absolutely. Mm. So right here I've got Tetratheca ciliata. I think it's Eliocarpe family. Is it Eliocarpe? I think so.
Tetratheca.
You better double check that. I'm pretty sure. A beautiful, profuse, pink flowering plant that you see growing all through the Yarra Valley, Dandenong Ranges, on the roadside. I think its common name Is it Black-Eyed Susan? Is it?
I don't. It's one, or just I think thyme. It's one of them, yeah.
Yeah, or just thyme. Native thyme.
I'm going to look up both of those things.
Yeah, so I brought this in because it's actually a very hardy plant in our gardens. If you've got sort of a little part shade sort of condition, we plant these around rocks. Now, you actually see this plant growing on the roadsides when you are down in the Yarra Valley. And it does get a lot of activity from all your insect species as well. But it is absolutely gorgeous. We'll put it on social media, obviously, so you can see pictures. But it's sort of the plant when we plant these in gardens that it kind of has a thyme-like appearance.
It does.
And then it comes to, you know, now in spring, and it just becomes this big pink blob. And it's stunning. It is one of those very dainty, beautiful plants, kind of looks like little fairy flowers. And it's relatively quite hardy, as long as it's not being blasted by sun, and you do want to sort of keep it a little bit moist too. Though, I do say, when you see this growing on the side of the road, it obviously, when it's seeded, it's very hardy. Mm. I think it's just more when you have it in a pot, sometimes it wants the conditions to be a little bit more moist. But if you ever get the lucky opportunity, if you're planting it in amongst rocks or anywhere where you've got sort of like disturbed site and it does get to seed, it is a fantastic plant.
Yeah.
And if it's on the roadside in the Yarra Valley, it's not getting that much rain.
That's what I mean. So that I find that, like, because I like to test plants. So I've had Tetratheca ciliata and I've planted in different areas. But when I have found where I put it in a site where, you know, I get a really quite hot summer and it really hits it, it doesn't like that. Yeah. And it dries out. And, then I go on driving down the road and I'm like, why is this thing growing there and it's in full sun on the side of the road with no soil?
Yeah. I've got pomodoros growing on the side of my road at the moment and they're beautiful.
Yeah. Some things are just like, I don't know, but yeah. Sorry, what
were you saying? But it does come from the sort of the higher rainfall. It's not a mallee thing.
No, it's not.
Inland thing. It's all through the ranges, the Otways.
Yes.
All through the ranges.
Yeah.
East Gippsland.
It's all the way through. But this is why it's such a nice plant to have, like in Melbourne, if you've got, you know, sort of a. It's a great situation here in Melbourne in a sort of part shaded condition. You've got moister soils, you're sort of looking after it. It's great.
In fact, I'll plant it in Sylvie's front garden.
You should.
She will
love
it.
It's gorgeous.
I suggested Clivia and she spat the dummy.
Oh,
no, not happy.
It comes in white. I don't know why the variations.
You can buy them as well.
You can buy them as well, absolutely. You can get them from Indigenous nurseries or you can get them from specialist nurseries like Karanga as more cultivated forms. It's wonderful.
Alia Carpaceae, big tip.
Yes.
Well done.
I wish everyone could
I'm trying to learn more of that side.
The view from my end of the studio right now is just beautiful with this salvia manual in front of me and these two beautifully flowering potted plants and like the computer open with all the information. It's such a good view.
Yeah, well, that's everyone. I think that's practically every Sunday morning at the Bruce Young Studio.
It's the most fun of the radio I've had.
You're going to come back. I hope so.
And then my other plant is from Western Australia, and it's a type of boronia. I've brought boronias in before. I'm a big fan of boronias.
Yeah.
A lot of people think of boronia as the scented ones, and we obviously can smell them in a lot of nurseries at the moment. But this is Boronia cymosa. You find this species sort of all on the eastern, all the way down to the southern coast of Western Australia. It is such a hardy boronia. I have got it planted in two sites at home, and it is just profuse with flowers. It doesn't have a scent from the flower itself. The scent is within the leaf. It's a long-living boronia. And the three sites that I have had it is, one's in my front garden, very quite heavy clay mountain soil, which is weird because it comes from sort of like very dry, sandy desert, well, not deserty, but it still gets flush of water along that east coast. It's found down in the Karri forests down in Western Australia as well. So quite varied. So it's a very varied habitat distribution.
Yeah. How hard can you prune it?
Quite hard. Yeah, I could, because when, see how with this plant, it's sort of coming off a little bit. I just take off these bits if I want to keep more bushy. I actually think if you leave it, though, it tends to just mound up as a blob.
Oh, I have one in my garden. I'm just showing a photo of it.
And look at it.
And it's as high as my shoulder.
That's See? Gorgeous.
It's incredible.
It's huge.
And the picture still doesn't do it justice compared to, like, as in the look.
Gives you an idea of the size. Oh, it is big.
That's enormous. That's fantastic.
It is huge.
Yeah, well, the other site that it's been is, like, also down in Shoreham. Nice. So, like, it is a really, really, really good Boronia.
Super adaptable.
Yes. If you want, you know, a native.
And what's its second name? Boronia?
Cymosa.
Cymosa.
C-Y-M-O-S-A.
I've never known its name. And it's very beautiful and it's as hardy.
It's hardy.
Because I'm not that good a gardener. I manage to lose delicate things quite often.
This ain't delicate.
I mean, there are some of
It looks delicate. It looks delicate with a pack of punch.
I mean, there are a few sort of drop-dead Boronias, but this is not one of them. How long would you expect that to persist in a garden? Like?
I've had mine...
Multiple years?
Well, mine so far now is 3.5 years.
Yeah. Mine's 10.
So yours 10. There we go.
At least 10.
Yeah. That's good value. Mm. Mm.
Yeah. Except that you can't walk down the path because I've never pruned it.
Be interesting.
So that's the question. How hard can I prune it?
I don't know how hard, but I have one and I've taken these little bits off, but I find...
Well, I'll experiment this year. I have to cut it back.
But I want to know how long it lives for.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be vicious. Yeah, I love it.
Okay, good.
And the birds love it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
for sure. Even though it's Western Australian, which is not native.
Yeah, really. Exactly.
I would have thought maybe prune, you know, after flowering about a third of it.
Yeah, that's what I think.
You know, almost...
I'll try exactly that.
Look, I think to hold it so it's nice and tight and dense, but that looks amazing unpruned.
Yeah. It is. It's but it gets... I've planted it on the south side of the house, so what it's done is it's just leant over to the light. I didn't give it enough light.
Yeah.
Because I'm hopeless.
There must be something too within the flowers because not or the whole plant itself because nothing really eats it, I've noticed as well.
Yeah, maybe it's the oils.
It must be.
Yeah.
I have a little wombat that goes in.
Wombat?
Yeah. You can see its little poos all down the kind of thing. And he's tipping every bloody plant with flowers. I'm watching my plants like in bud. I'm like, oh, here it comes. It's going to flower. And then I come back for the weekend. It's been trimmed and I didn't get to see the flowers. Doesn't want to eat this thing though, does it? I've got some flowers in the garden. Well,
and for me, the rabbits are such a problem and they don't eat my salvias. So that's one of the reasons I've got so many salvias because they don't eat them.
Yeah.
The foliage is really aromatic, so it's like probably full of oils.
I would say so.
Yeah.
So
I wish I had a wombat problem rather than a rabbit problem.
Wombat. That's why I can't hate it. No, it's a wombat.
Does your wombat have a name?
It did scare the hell out of me one night when we were renovating. I thought this was before we renovated the house. It was like an old cedar house and it was a little bit creepy looking. And I thought, I'm going to stay here by myself tonight. So I stayed. At 2 o'clock in the morning, I hear this like the floorboards are being ripped up underneath me. And I woke up, my heart's pounding. What the hell? The house is falling and what's this ripping? And then I hear this little noise. And I was like, oh, it's a wombat sneezing underneath me, ripping up the floorboards underneath my bed. My goodness. So this wombat, I have this like love hate for it because it likes to trim my flowers, wake me up, scares me at night. Like, I should give him a name, Terror.
Sounds fabulous.
Yeah.
But Ronias is actually quite a big group.
Like, it's huge.
Over 100 species and in every state or certainly up the Western Australia, up the eastern seaboard, Tassie. Great group of plants.
Oh, it's starting to become a bit of an obsession. I'm collecting a whole lot of them. I've got like the cilia. And now I'm Dania. I've just got a whole range of them and I just want to keep collecting. But the non-scented, as in the aromatic ones, they're the ones that live. The beautiful scented ones tend to drop dead after about a couple of years. Yeah, yeah.
And they've also, is that Megastigma?
Yeah, Megastigmas. Yeah, that's beautiful smell.
Gorgeous, amazing smell. You know, some people can't smell it.
I know.
Yes, right. Somebody's just asking, do either of these have a fragrance, Em?
No. Oh, actually, the Tetratheca does have a sweet smell. It does have a slight smell, but the foliage but of... foliage is scented for the baronia.
Yes, because I don't particularly think my baronia, which is this one, has a scent.
Yeah, like I've just, it's a bit like a coria smell.
Mm. The in the same family.
It is.
Yeah.
More local baronias do smell, but they are much harder to grow. This one's very tough.
Mm. Very tough.
Great.
We have some others. Hi, everyone. I went to Bolobec yesterday and got to chat with Ben and Kerry. So many gorgeous plants. Then after that, I went for an excellent visit to Stephen Ryan. A wonderful, if expensive, day out. Highly recommended. That was Dave from Upway. The other one we've done, a super light dusting of blood and bone around plants I want to protect, and it keeps the wombats at bay.
Oh.
That's from Terry.
I should do that for Terror.
You can call him Terry the Terror.
Terry. We'll call him Terry.
Tezza.
I'm calling it Tez.
So that's excellent. That is excellent. So we move to some more plants, John Arnott.
I've got a couple that are flowering in my garden at the moment. Tiny little postage stamp garden in Bayside, Melbourne. But it's got, I brought in Eremophila nivea, and one of the forms of Eremophila nivea. Mm. I mean, Eremophila's, you know, pretty solid garden plants, really good for dry environments. Mm. But the lovely thing about Eremophila nivea, it has beautiful flowers at this time of the year, but its foliage is just so soft and downy, and I'll pass that around. It's actually...
It's such a soft, soft grey. It's not even grey, is it? It's almost silver.
It's silver. Beautiful plant. We've had Eremophilas in and out of the garden since we moved in about 7 years ago. But the nivea is this kind of the showstopper. And in such a small garden, something like Eremophila nivea can actually be a structural plant in the garden.
Yep.
Because it's grey and your eye catches it. And,
is it grafted?
This one's not. No. This is on its own root. So I think this is actually just a straight species. But there are some cultivated varieties and some grafted forms and of the Eremophila nivea. So I brought that in.
Do you think it particularly likes your soil because it's sandy?
I think it's sort of, I don't know, I think on a graft it's pretty resilient. You see it, all over.
Yeah, we planted a lot, I usually prefer using the non-grafted and we plant it all through Northcote.
Works well?
Works very well. It doesn't work in any areas where it gets frosted, any frost.
Frost.
Dead.
Okay.
Instant.
Winter wet? Does it sulk?
No, it doesn't like that because the hairs on the foliage hold the moisture and cause it to die as well. So, it's in a good environment if it's coastal,
exposed,
and no frost sort of.
I haven't tried it at mine, but my clay would probably take it. You think? Because the frost doesn't stay with me; it just rolls straight off.
Yes, I've got one. I put one in at Hoddle's and it got wet and it's still alive, but it's still alive. So it got wet and what happens, I find the plant itself is a lot smaller. I've got it sort of on a little bit of a slope. But it doesn't get the beautiful, you know how like yours would probably be nearly a 1.5 by 1.5?
Yeah, exactly.
And just like it doesn't seem to want to get to that full shrub height, so you kind of get a smaller plant. That's what I found.
Yeah.
Well, it'll be interesting. I'll try one at mine.
I would, yeah.
Hoddles and Seville, they're close.
I think it'll do a lot better at your place because Hoddles Creek is very wet, a lot wetter.
I wish I was a bit wetter.
It's like a little nursery.
Ooh, can I tell an Eremophila story?
Yeah.
I was like, I didn't know that we were supposed to bring plants in because I would have brought something in. But
I should have said. I just have fun stories.
Bring yourself in.
Let's do the virtual
Eremophila. Well, I love Eremophilas because when I've done a lot of field work or bird watching in the Mallee in South Australia and edge of Victoria, and Eremophilas are always the plant to look when they're flowering for really cool honey eaters. Or even new bee species. We found a new bee species in Eremophila out in central South Australia. It's just such a good plant for wildlife. Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah. And dense.
The
maculatas.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different forms and colours. Oh.
Well, this would clearly be an excellent one for Merribeck to be planting in some of its parks.
Mm.
Mm.
Does Merribeck have an indigenous plants priority?
I think, yeah, we do. And this year, some of our Brunswick councillors pushed for more funding for understory planting. So that's happening. I think we got, yeah,
that's
a bit extra. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
The other plant I brought in, it's a half-sided bottle brush. So it's one of the calothamnus.
I love those calothamnus.
Calothamnus quadrifidus. Western Australian, again, just doing beautifully in my sand. I actually planted it in the wrong place and I've had to prune it. I planted it down the side of the driveway and it wants to sort of be as wide as it is tall. Hmm. So I've been clipping it and it's actually producing a really interesting, almost a spaliate form of the shrub. So you can actually see the structure of the stem, of the branches. Hmm. And it's interesting that it flowers not on new growth, it flowers on last year's growth.
We will actually take a photograph of that exact plant after the show and put it on. Because it's fabulous. The shape is fabulous.
Yeah, and it literally is. It looks bottle brush-like, but, you know, bottle brushes are, you know, it's completely circular around the stem of the plant. But this is really, it quite literally is growing. The flowers are on half the side of the stems.
They're beautiful, aren't they? I've got an orange one.
Yeah.
I love my orange one.
Which is the species of calothamnus that has more of a spiky foliage because it's growing up on the Parliament House rooftop.
I'm not sure.
Which you visit regularly, do you, dear?
I actually did recently. I just got to speak to politicians and went up there the NGIV.
Oh, so you went to the NGIV. Because that is a Paul Thompson garden, a remarkable. Is it any good?
Happened is 3 years ago, Karanga actually gave them a whole new suite of plants.
Right.
And they've pop them in, and it's doing incredibly. They've got like Grevillea, it's spiky with a purple flower, botrycordia. I don't know. A bit like Grevillea sinapia.
Spiky. Yeah.
And then they've got these calothamnus species, which they've trimmed, and it's got a spikier foliage. I've got pictures. They've got Ostromyrtus, different types of kangaroo pores. The Darwinias are doing incredibly.
Oh, I love a Darwinia too.
Yeah, it is actually, it looks fantastic. It's really good.
And it's a roof garden.
It's a roof garden, but the species that have been selected that were from Karanga are doing really, really, really well. Yeah.
Well, and of course, this is what the new garden at Fed Square is effectively a roof garden. A lot of our gardens in the city are actually roof gardens.
Sorry, I'm just showing.
Yeah, no, that's actually a form of quadrifidus.
It's quadrifidus.
But it's really, really spiky.
It's really spiky. It was like a pine and it's all been like, they've obviously kept it hedged. That's a picture of Virginia.
Beautiful. We put that on our
absolutely.
Socials.
And I'll do it. Oh, it looks amazing. That's what we had heaps of it at Cranbourne. So we'll give a positive ID on it and we'll upload it.
Yeah, because I was touching it and the foliage was just completely different to normal colour. Yeah.
Well, that sort of very prickly foliage would be excellent for the small birds.
Exactly. And obviously that's why it's used in the Woody Meadow project. It can be trimmed. It can be hedged. It can be.
It can be coppiced.
It can anything. You're espaliered, and you know.
Yeah, that's right.
and when you think about it, Russell's garden at Fed Square is effectively a roof garden.
You had a look at that during the week.
It is.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I went for a walk last weekend. I went for a walk on Football Friday.
Oh.
And everybody was rushing around, and I was really slow.
Football Friday.
Yes, I sort of forgot and went.
Besides Chloe Foster, who loves footy, I don't really know many people in the plant world who love football that much. Or do you, John? Are you a football fanatic?
Oh, yeah, football man.
Yeah, you are. Yeah, you and Chloe then.
is that the one? No.
No.
No, okay.
It's thicker.
Okay.
Now, as nobody can see this, I think we'll kill this guy.
Yeah, sorry.
We're just plant nerding on the side.
Yeah, we're plant nerding, sorry. Yeah.
Well, when my garden was on Gardening Australia, they held it to the grand final weekend because my dad broadcast about 30 grand finals for
the ABC. That's right, because your dad was
Oh,
of course.
And yeah. so they had an image of Dad on because it was the football. It was the grand final weekend. So it was last year at the grand final.
That'd be so nice for you.
Sometimes I'm flipping through Foxtel and I hear Dad's voice.
That is so. Is that weird?
Oh, yeah. Well, he's over 100. So yes, it's very weird. And he's been dead for quite a long time.
Is it nice to hear him though?
Oh yes, he had a very distinctive radio voice.
Well, so do you.
Oh, I don't know. Yes.
Yes, you have a distinctive radio voice.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he had a very distinctive radio voice. Yeah. Anyway, football is not what we're here to talk about.
It could be pinafolius.
Yes.
That sounds like it. Yes. It would be. Pinafolia is the perfect name.
Yes, it is. And the thing is, yes, being a rooftop garden, it was very interesting to see the selection of plant species because these species are. They're a lot more shallow-rooted, which is what makes them ideal, but obviously where they come from, you know, when you're observing roof gardens, that they're the sort of species that you want to have. You want shallow-rooted systems that don't need too much soil. Mm. They are usually in conditions that are quite harsh, and it was really great to see, like, the plant selection through there was that, which is... Yeah, obviously they do need a bit more water though, because just like if we get those windy days when you're dealing with 200 mil soil, 1,000 mil of soil, you lose 10 centimetres of water evaporation easily in a day, if not 15. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And calathemas don't have a lignotuber per se, but they seem to. Yeah, they're perfect for that application.
They are. Yeah, they really are. Yeah. And the fact that we do have a few different species and they all seem to respond the same way is good. Another big thing of calathemas and eremophilas, I always do a thing where I test plants at my dad's garden, like at the farm.
Yep.
If it survives there, it survives anywhere, sure. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
So these all survived and thrived, and that says something. They can live anywhere.
The sort of thing that... requires water, but can have long intervals between those events. And so it's sort of got some.
And this
some
is
of
those part of
adaptability.
Well, it's going to be very interesting in Europe watching because you know Italy, for example, you've got roof gardens, you've got plants draped down buildings everywhere. Mm. Paris, the same. Mm. And as they get hotter and drier, they're going to have to deal with this.
Yes.
Like we do. I mean, it's much harder to do a roof garden here than it is. It was, in Europe.
And it was hotter there than it is here. Like when I was in Europe this year and last year, in that heat and because all the cities are so built.
Dense.
And dense, it is hotter than here. Like it really is. It is stifling. And then when you're in like other cities like, say, Prague and Budapest and places like that, the thing is, they've never prioritized planting in the cities, and now they are because they are literally cooking, and they've never had to have plants. It just shows you how this has changed so quickly because they've never had plants before because it's never been an issue. They didn't even have air conditioning because it's never been an issue, and now it is like 40 degrees in there, and the radiant temperature coming off these buildings and the cobblestone streets. Mm. Oh, wow. It's hot.
Well, London at 33. Is unbearable.
Yeah.
Because no one's got aircon.
No one.
You would never afford to.
But also the windows only open like a little bit. You know, you can't throw the window open, and there's cross ventilation in those flats that nobody's ever thought of it.
Yeah.
You know, and it is extraordinary because at 33 in London, I'll withdraw to the house, whereas I'd never do that here.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I really notice that.
Yeah. Some calathemas do have lignotubers.
They do? Mm. I didn't know that.
Well, so they probably wouldn't do as well on a rooftop garden.
Oh, I think they do fine.
Do you?
Better, yeah, because they can store it up a little bit. You know, a bit of a reserve sitting there, you might be able to coppice to that point when it gets, you know, too big or too leggy or, go back to the reserves of the plant in the lignotuber.
Because the biggest thing with roof gardens, if you always need to water them a bit more or at least have, like, some sort of wicking reserve at the base.
Yeah.
And I know with roof garden, that's usually the thing that scares you the most is because waterproofing, and I mean everything waterproofing these days is failing everywhere from builds.
Oh,
and
as in water sitting on the top of a roof structure. Yeah, okay.
And I think that is like one of the biggest concerns when you do roof gardens is to this essentially needs to be a proper pool. But you can imagine even pools can crack or, you know, you still get like perforations. And so when you're dealing with a roof garden with soil and you need to find where that is, it can be pretty, yeah, so.
So is this turning to be a real issue, is it?
Yes. Yeah. It is. It's like it needs to be a formula when you create these roof gardens that this, the basically the pool that it's going into, let's call it pools because that's what it is essentially. It's a container.
Yeah.
It needs to be so foolproof because of that weight load, the water load, and then even like how the plants develop and what they're doing with their root systems, like it needs to be so foolproof.
Mm.
And the reason why I'm bringing this up is it's just like when we're dealing with water, when you create like a wetland or a pond, the scariest part is filling it because you don't know if you've by mistake done the hairline pinch in that line or even in the clay, whatever you've done.
Because water will find it.
Water will find it. Yep. It finds the spot that is structurally unsound. It'll find the weakest point and it will make its way through.
Yep. And question, do you have ways of finding that spot in your dams?
You can do, you have to kind of wait for things to clear up and you can put a dye. Mm. And you put a non-toxic dye, which then travels. Yeah, okay. And sometimes you can see them go... and suck it in.
That's cool.
And that's how you find leaks. And that's what I'm saying. You can't find a leak when it's covered in soil.
No.
And it's very hard when it's dirty water and things like that. Mm. And obviously you're looking for pools. So when on the opposite side of any wetland, you have to wait a few weeks, but you'll notice the grass will go green. Yeah, and you're like, aha.
The indicator, there it is.
We're looking for indicators.
This is such a fascinating discussion because I'm thinking from the urban planning lens and all the new rooftop gardens going up in Brunswick and... Mm. That we want more of them, but so hard.
It is. And I guess the issue at the moment too is that there is such a load on construction. And also how the construction is going ahead. Like there has been a big issue with new apartments being built and having to be built so quickly.
Mm.
And it means that like anything, when you rush something, problems happen or mistakes happen or things aren't done properly. And so waterproofing on buildings and infrastructure is a real big problem.
Mm.
The amount of places that we visit of apartments and they've had to go to like, you know, body corporate because roofs are falling in, balconies are having waterproof issues and they're going into the house. It's like a big, big thing.
Mm.
So in terms of us trying to put plants on people's balcony and, you know, then you're watering it, where's that water going?
Mm.
These are all the things that we have to really think about. And we're seeing it on all the new apartments, especially some really big concerns with waterproofing.
Because it's ticking an environmental box or an energy rating box. I had heard that a rooftop garden without plants, but just with the media, is almost as effective as doing the insulation.
I would say so. And that's a funny thing because you know, my partner being Norwegian, we go to Norway, and a lot of the roofs over there are all planted grassed roofs.
Thatch.
They're actually soil.
Alive.
Oh, they're no, they're alive. Right. No, they're living, alive. Living roofs.
Right, cool.
And you go into these structures and it's completely silent for a start.
Right.
The thermal, I mean, they insulate everything anyway, but the way that the roof is insulated, like we're dealing with about 250 to 300 mil of soil on all these roofs.
Right.
And all these grass material, like grasses grow on the roof and then obviously the load that it has to when it snows. You find it all through, like, the areas where it skis. It's incredible. And very simple houses.
Yeah.
Like,
And they're not having leaking problems.
They don't.
Why?
They have, like, when you see the layers of the lining that they're doing on these houses, there was, like, three layers that I observed, and I still obviously can't see what's happening under when they first create them. But I saw three different layers.
Horizons.
Yeah. Mm. The other thing too is the structures are obviously sloped.
Mm.
So it means that water is always able to sort
of get off.
But it must be very difficult to get it started if you're working with that slope.
I don't. Well, the grasses that they're using tend to colonise pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I'll put a photo of this on 3CR as well as something else to talk about because I've got some beautiful photos of these roofs. And like when I think about it here in Australia, you know, it is a different climate. If you wanted to do these sort of roof systems, you could do it, but you'd almost need to have it where there's a little bit of irrigation allowing to go through, and you would definitely use grass species. You'd use poas and things like that, and that's what they have. That's their naturally occurring grass that they're using.
That's interesting, isn't it? It's
because we tend to have them on flat roofs.
Yeah, and this is the thing. And I, dealing with water, I do think about this a lot. When you are holding, it's a weight, huge weight. So it's about, like, how do you create a system that sort of naturally works like an environment does, you know, where, you know, water needs to escape.
It's sort Is it about pitch, maybe? Pitch of roof?
Might be slight, maybe slight grade.
Yeah.
Mm. So maybe all the roofs need to be on a slight grade where the water can sort of come off, and it takes away that weight.
Only 15 or 20% rather than the steep pitched roof that you find in Norway.
Yeah, just very small. Mm. And then what that could do is the water could run into like a reservoir at the side of that construction, and it might be recirculated.
Yeah. Sure.
And that would be just a system. Like whenever we're dealing with roofs, and I think about this all the time, it's like we even had a bike shed where it was like 250 mil of soil. And I was like, well, we're going to use indigenous plants, the basalt, you know, Melbourne basalt plants. The thing is, the way these systems work is you've got a basalt outcrop, you have flushes of water and these tiny pockets of water that used to exist within this landscape, right? So if you're mimicking the landscape, this is, we create a 30 mil wicking reservoir that always stays with water, and we put poas and wallenbergias and chrysocephalum, and you can even some brush species, juncus.
Yeah.
This hasn't failed since. And it stayed up. Nothing.
There you go.
So you think it was partly the planting as well?
Yes. You want to choose plant species that tolerate having some sort of wicking system, or want that little bit of a reservoir, can still tolerate heat conditions, like a hot environment, shallow soil, an environment that is around rocks and infrastructure, so the radiant heat from buildings. Mimic.
Yeah. It's interesting. There's probably much easier solution to not using Australian plants.
Yes.
Like with South African succulents and, you know, maybe some of those things. It's an interesting little philosophical debate, the practicality versus the philosophy.
Yes.
It's cool.
I think it's more the reason why I use those plants is because I've observed it.
Yeah.
Mm. So I definitely see the value in using exotic species in those applications, but also at the same time I'm really interested in what our local and native species can do. And when in a cultivated sense, if you're trimming them, if you're giving them water, my goodness, the way they respond is something else.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people just sit and forget.
So it's about those underlying conditions. You can do it, but there's some requirements.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
We have a call, so let's have a go. Our caller is Gloria from Bulleen. Hello.
Hi, Virginia.
How are you?
I'm good. Listen, I'm getting feedback on this.
I'm afraid there's nothing I can do about that, darling.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. I just hear myself speaking. Look, I don't know his name, but I said, could you put me on to the Birdman?
Jay.
Birds and bees, yeah.
Birds and bees.
Yeah, birds and bees. Jay, is it?
Yes, hi.
Hi, Jay. Look, I've been living in this house and garden for 30 years, and what do you call them? Those nasty little pesky birds. What are they?
The noisy miners. Everyone knows them.
Well, when I came, I wrote down something like 30 different species of birds when we arrived, back in my bird book. And the miners have taken over, and they're so aggressive. And, I mean, I had a kookaburra, which is wonderful, a kookaburra in the garden a couple of weeks ago, and these miners kept attacking it.
Mm-hmm.
And a butcher bird sat up in the tree watching this. It was his entertainment, I think. But is there anything I can do? I mean, I have a friend who runs the Grafton Tree Farm up in Grafton, and he sent me a slingshot, but I said, no, I live in a built-up area. It wouldn't do, but I've got a squirter, a bottle of water that I can squirt. But is there anything I can do to get rid of these little...
Well, short term, probably it's difficult. There's a noisy miner in my tree harassing a little ringtail possum, and I kept trying to shoo them away, and they just come back, and they're just relentless. I think short term it's hard. Long term, it's about the habitat structure and getting things that make those miners uncomfortable, and that's like places for other birds to hide. There's a PhD student who's now a postdoc at RMIT who I work with in a lab, and they've done a study on what kind of habitats are really good for miners and what can kind of bring in other bird species. And it is just really about understory plantings and a little bit less eucalypts, because that's, you know, a lot of nectar for them. So yeah, it's hard. Yeah. I know even the city of Adelaide was looking at culling noisy miners because of problems in gardens, but you know, that's a very contentious issue.
Yeah, and also you're much better off changing the environment than culling them, aren't you?
Yeah, it's just harder. It takes a while for plants to get established, and I wonder if there's even some kind of artificial structures you can put in temporarily. But
like what?
Good question. Just like some branches and things for other birds to hide in. Piling it in certain places.
Mm. Yeah.
I think even bringing some of the more predatory species, though, that's something I've observed. Like I know you got kookaburras, but there's a very different line when, like, you're in urban to rural areas that you have more predatory species. Mm. And I think they might even have something.
Yeah, I got to get some falcons in.
Yeah,
but even magpies.
I get a couple of magpies. We're good friends, actually, but they just sit and watch.
It's funny. Mm. It's funny you say with the butcher bird, because I've observed too that they don't tend to bother the butcher birds, but they definitely do just watch.
They do.
I've watched it too.
I think John's suggestion, a bit of brush piled around might do the trick until plants get established and grow into those spaces.
Mm. Yeah.
Get some what?
Some melaleuca brush, or cut bits of foliage which has still got the cut branches that have still got foliage on it.
Mm. And just have them so that the smaller birds have got somewhere to hide.
And just so they don't have that that nice, you know, clear pathway they just fly through and swoop around in, right?
Yeah.
Right. That's interesting.
Make life hard for them.
Modify the environment a bit.
Because in the front, my front garden is very bushy, but the back garden is does have a bit of a lawn, but it's got tall yew trees around it.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, like Jay said, there has been a priority of eucalypt species, and same with the bell miners, is like the certain type of eucalypt species also allow for that lerp to grow.
Mm.
And so it's creating a food source which is prioritising, and this is when we talk about hierarchy within our urban areas, about how these sort of things start to create this, you know, hierarchies of how these species infiltrate and move in. So it does take a bit of time, but
Miners with the lerp, it's a food source for the miners.
It's sweet. If you can eat them yourself, take off that little cap and eat it. Sugar.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they're protecting their food source and patch by keeping all the other birds away.
It's very smart.
That would normally predate on the...
Yeah.
Oh, God, it's
so smart.
Isn't it?
And miner species in particular are one of the most smartest bird species. Yeah.
And they're social. They've got their friends to back them up.
Yeah, they're bullies. They literally are like gangs. They're gang birds.
A mob.
Yeah,
they're mobs. They're an army of them.
Yeah.
They're pretty easy to trap. Like if you get a miner in a trap, you have more miners.
But it's not going to help unless you change the environment.
Mm, yeah, I think it's a long-term process. Yeah.
You have to have things that make that big bits of grass that they like are no longer there.
And it's that thing like when we were saying before, like, you know, the transition of what's happened in the last 10 years around Melbourne, where they've introduced more of these native gardens, you know, you start to see a change, like you're seeing more miners. So what's happening and what will happen in the next 10 years when we prioritise more understory now that we know this, then you might see that this will start to dwindle a little bit more.
Advantage the others.
Yeah, we have to remember too, environments are quite slow when they, like, we speed it up, of course, because we're planting it, but environments are slow to adapt. And if you leave it, you know, you won't, it's hard to see the change straight away, but look at it over a 10-year span. Yeah.
Are you saying the miners like native gardens? They have a preference?
They do. They love open. They like all, but they do like open, treed gardens with lawns and ovals, like where they can see. Because it's like, imagine being a bully. You can see where everything is.
And they love all the nectar plants.
And they love all the nectar plants. Yeah. So then when times are good, they breed. So, like, it's about, and you know, like a bully. If you can see the kid you want to bully around the corner, then you're going to keep bullying. So what we need to do is we need to create more shrubs and things like that to let those poor kids that get bullied to be able to hide and have respite, and then they can form their own gangs inside their bushes and get them back, you know?
Yeah. We should give them a little bit of credit. They're remarkably adaptable, you know, and I've seen noisy miners in the city eating, licking crushed Skittles on the ground.
Yes.
They're so smart.
And this is what we're talking about, the adaptability. Yeah. And the thing is, the other thing that we don't notice is we don't see that we have those brown sparrows anymore.
Mm. I know.
Because there's the change in the way that these hierarchies is. So now but the thing is, the brown sparrows are exotic. But now because we see too many miners, but they're native. So, like, you can see, like, all hierarchies always happen.
And it's the brown sparrows are threatened in Britain.
There you go.
So, actually, we don't want to get rid of them here.
Yeah. So, there's all, you know, it's always about observing and understanding, and because time feels quite slow when we see these things, but these changes are happening amongst us all the time.
They're hiding in plain sight.
Oh, so in plain sight.
Amazing. It'll be a process, but I think, there's a lot of, that's a lot of good information there. Yeah.
Gloria, I hope that's been helpful, darling. We're getting quite close to the end of our show.
Okay, well, thanks. So put away the slingshot.
And plant more shrubs. Dense, spiky shrubs.
And cut some branches if you've got some, and pile them in certain places.
Teepee sort of thatches.
Yeah, thatches.
Make them really lovely and artistic so the small birds can go in there and those sort of things.
A refuge.
Good advice.
Yeah.
Good advice.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for the show.
Bye. Thanks, darling.
Thank
Bye.
You.
So that was very interesting. Unfortunately, we can't talk to Carl because we're too late.
Oh, sorry.
Where's it gone? They've stolen my Carl message. No, there it is. Morning, guys, ladies. I visited our local Indigenous nursery, Candlebark, in Murralbark, and was amazed by their service. They asked my location, then looked up the likely vegetation communities on my property before European settlement and gave me a web link for them. So that was Carl from Croydon. So that, I think, for people who live around there, Candlebark in Murralbark will clearly be really useful.
And the knowledge Indigenous nursery people have is really
absolutely
incredible.
And there's
incredible.
A whole network of them, isn't
so
there?
So many.
Yeah.
And the producers are... just put up a message. Wattle birds are bullies. Is that right?
Yeah. They are. All those medium-sized birds. Mm.
The wattle birds at my place are vile to the the little
honey eaters.
You can
hear them snap. Mm. Yeah. Everyone's trying to survive and thrive.
Yeah.
You know.
It's a good resource, nectar.
Yeah.
The bees can fight themselves too.
Yeah, can they?
Mm. Oh. It's very interesting. Good stories. We don't have time for them, but bees fight.
We will definitely make another time for bee fights. I think that sounds absolutely fascinating, because I think it is actually really important that we provide a habitat that is balanced so that everybody gets a go.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't try and get rid of the wattle birds at my place. I just watch them being mean. But that's their role. That's fine.
Yeah. I mean, humans can be pretty mean to each other.
We do know about that. Well, I think we better say goodbye to everybody. Next week, John is on again, and he will have with him Jane Tonkin, Meryl Johnson, and Stephen Wells.
What a lovely lineup.
That's a really good lineup.
So it'll be another excellent program. Mm. And I think we've had a good time today. Today we've had John Arnott, Jay Iwasaki. We've enjoyed having you, Jay. I hope you'll come back.
Such a lovely first experience.
Welcome. Excellent. Yeah. And Emmeline.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Emmeline.
Nice.
And I hope you've all massively enjoyed our day today. And I hope that the people who are well away from our areas and still find it very interesting. Thank you, everybody. Goodbye.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.